Management. Mr. Warshon, when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Michael Warshon. I'm here representing myself in this case, a case about automated debt collection calls to address the district court's decision granting summary judgment on all counts under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and under the Maryland Telephone Consumer Protection Act. There's a separate issue on discovery that would be resolved depending how the substantive issues are resolved. What I'm going to focus on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is the kind of single decision of the district court that had the effect of resolving all three counts, 1, 2, and 3, which was the court's determination that the collector in this case had a reasonable belief to believe it had the wrong or that there was additional information that could have been obtained by continuing calling.
Let me ask you just on that point, because that's the point I'm most interested in, at least right now in this case. I'm going to paraphrase the statute for you. I'm sure you probably know the statute. But as I read the statute, it basically says the debt collector may call again if the debt collector reasonably believes that the earlier call was incomplete, that the response in the earlier call was incomplete. You agree with me that's what the statute says?
That's part of it, but yes.
Well, I'm going to focus on that part.
Okay.
Okay. And if that's the case, I look at your complaint. As I understand it, now I'm reading from page 9 of the transcript. This is paragraph 15. It says, during the call on May 27, 2010, plaintiff pressed the 2 option to select the choice that I was not Martha. But even after pressing 2, the pre-recorded woman's voice then gave me still more prompts and options, and I hung up a few seconds later without pressing any more options. Given that allegation in your complaint, how could we find that a reasonable person would do otherwise than believe your response was not complete? Because they've asked you other things, you haven't answered them. So why wouldn't a reasonable person think your response was incomplete?
Because there were no further questions than pressing 2 to say I'm not, in this case, Martha, is a complete and correct response.
No, that's a response to one question, not a response to the call, as I see it. I think if that's all that you'd asserted was that you'd pressed 2 and then that was all, you would have an argument that a reasonable person might think your response was complete. But that's not what you assert in your complaint, that you heard other prompts and options. But you hung up without responding to that. So why wouldn't a reasonable person think, as a matter of law, that your response was incomplete?
Well, I would go back to even before they call as to what reasonable belief did the debt collector have when it first started calling.
That may be nice, but that didn't answer my question. I'm focused just on the statute. As I understand the statute allows the debt collector to call more than once if it believes in that the call in which you give some response says your response was not complete. If a reasonable person, that's a reasonable person standard, would believe that your response was incomplete, they may call back a second time or another time or several times. They're limited by the law, as I read it, when a reasonable person thinks your response is complete. But I don't see how a reasonable person could think that when you assert that you heard them asking or directing you to do more, but you opted not to do it.
Because you have to ask yourself, well, what did they reasonably believe at all times in the process before they even asked their first question in this instance? And by that, I would direct it to page 37 of the joint appendix, which shows the information that the debt collector got from, in this case, Lexis, about this account that they were collecting on, the other phone numbers. And as you can see, they simply got three phone numbers, two of which were mine, one of which was the one they called, and a third number in the 301 area code, which was my brother. So the debt collector only has cryptic information. They're just given a phone number from a search algorithm of Lexis. The debt collector has no reasonable belief about anything about it, really.
I don't mean to be cute, but that's not responsive to my question. Okay. The question is, when they called you the first time, you can argue about whether or not they had some basis to call you, but I'm just focusing on this. They called you once, and under the law, they may not call you a second time unless they reasonably believe your response was incomplete. Why wouldn't they believe your response was incomplete when you heard other prompts and or inquiries, you call them prompts and options, and did not respond to them? It seems to me that almost makes it as a matter of law for a reasonable person to think your response was incomplete.
Because you would have to have the debt collector presume that the person that we're assuming the first part is correct, that I'm not...
No, it doesn't have anything to do with presuming anything. The question is whether or not what a reasonable person would understand as to whether or not your response was complete.
All right, then instead of presume, I'll say believe. Could they reasonably believe that the person that they now know is not the target debtor has any information?
Sure. They could reasonably believe that. They could believe that you might be the husband. That you might, if they have a number that's associated with her, I'm not saying it's a great practice or anything, but I'm looking at the statute. Sure they can. It might be, you might have Martha's son on the phone. I don't know what it might be, but that's not the question. The question is whether or not the response was, if they could reasonably believe the response was complete or incomplete. You could call somebody, you could call my house and get me, ask for my wife, and I'd say, I'm not her. But they might say, well, is she there? Might be the next question. And if I heard, if someone were to call a couple's home and they say, we're looking for Sue Smith, are you Sue Smith? And you say, no, I'm not Sue Smith. They then would have and ask another question. Well, is she there? And if you hang up, wouldn't that be every reason to believe your response is not complete? It's not a question of responding completely to one question. It's the response to the call, I think.
Possibly, but your example is assuming a fact that's not in the record, which is that
second... I just gave that as a hypothetical.
Okay. Not in this case. And your question does get somewhat to the problem with, you kind of commented on, maybe it's not the best practice, is using the automated equipment because it doesn't allow the debt collector any interaction or the person receiving the call.
Is there anything in the statute that doesn't allow automated equipment?
No.
In my humble opinion, I wish it were, but I don't. There's not that I can find in the statute.
No,
I don't even like automated people. When you call somebody else and they have somebody on robo answer, I'd like to talk to a person, but that's not what the statute deals with, as I can understand.
No, you're right. This statute does not directly restrict automated practices. But
let me direct yourself and dovetail on Judge Shedd's question here to that same little section there. Let's look at the word communicating. That's an interesting word there because it actually is defined within the statute to say communication is conveying of any information about a debt. What information was conveyed about the debt by asking whether you are this person?
Their prompts in the brief, and we also produced a disc.
But you hung up after you hit the two, didn't you? I mean, if you start hearing other stuff, you hung up before you knew it was about a debt, didn't you?
Well, because I'm an attorney, I had a little bit more high knowledge. But no, you knew. I knew enough about the prompts that You could tell it's about a debt.
But had they conveyed it, I mean, that's nice for you to anticipate. Yeah, this sounds like it. I've heard this a lot. But the statute says conveying the information. Even though you may know it, if it's not conveyed, it's not, doesn't seem to meet that definition of communicating.
Well, the script that they said that they use, which is...
Let's make it nice and simple. What was it that you heard before you hit two?
Well, in this case, their name, Accounts Receivable Management, at some point is stated in their script.
What was on the recorded message when you picked up the phone, when you first heard it, what did you hear?
The first thing you hear is a pre-recorded...
I want to know what you heard. What did you hear?
I want to be fair, because it's been a while, and as indicated, some of these were in the morning.
Truthful in the way you give it to us. What did you hear?
Something along the lines of what's on page 7 of my...
How many those words that you, to the best of your knowledge, I'm not going to hold it to you to the extent of saying you misrepresent.
Well, it says, this is a message for, and then the name is inserted, Martha. Then it says, if this is not Martha, hang up or disconnect now. Then it says, by continuing to listen to this message, you acknowledge that you are, inserts Martha. Then it says, and this is, gets maybe to your point, this is accounts receivable management, and this is an attempt to collect a debt. And that's on the...
That is said before you hit two.
As best as I can recall, that the two pressing came a little bit later. But that's part of the problem, especially at a summary judgment where there may be facts in dispute, is that what I just read from you, which is on their disc of their call, doesn't include the press two option. So they had apparently a slightly different script that was delivered to me, and I was in the presence of mind to, you know, copy it or dictate it down, and it wasn't recorded. But what I just read to you, and they say that is their script, you know, that would...
Wait a second.
Communicate
it. To respond to Judge Wynn, you have to say what the record reflects is a response to his question. Are you saying that you don't know what was said when that call came in? I thought you asserted throughout there was at least this in the call. Are you Martha, press one if you are, press two if you're not? Don't you assert? Isn't that what you assert?
Yeah, I heard the name Martha.
And then what else in the record do you assert? And I'm just asking this to find out in the record, do you assert was said in that phone call? You just said they've come up with a script. That wasn't exactly... Are you saying that was not the script that was used with you? Or you don't know?
No, I'm saying there has to be something more than the script that they produced, which I just read, because that script does not include the if press to if you're... if.
Well, that's fine, but as to that something more, is it in the record what you say that something more was?
No, because as I just said, I wasn't in the presence of mind when these calls, and it's only two that I can say that I actually heard. I believe my time up.
Okay.
All right.
You okay on that? You have reserved some time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lynch.
May it please the court, my name's John Lynch, and I represent the Appalee Accounts Receivable Management. I wanted to start with what we believe the reasons why the...
I want to start with a question to you, the same question I ask of him. You heard my question, did you?
Did.
And do you see the statute the way that I see it, at least that part of it, which is there's only one, may communicate one time, unless the caller, the debt collection company, reasonably believes the response was incomplete. You agree with me on that?
Judge Shedd, I completely agree with you on that.
Good. We can both read the statute. And second, now let me get to my question. Then how do we rely on the allegation in the complaint for summary judgment purposes? It's an allegation.
No, in this case, we believe this is the, you know, textbook definition of an incomplete call. Mr. Warstrom, in his deposition testimony, he said as soon as he hit two, he hung up.
Well, then you might lose the case on that point. because that then a reasonable person might take that to be a complete response.
But he also knew he could stay on the line. He was directed to stay on the line to listen to an agent.
Well, how do we know that? How do we know that in the record?
Because that's what he said during his deposition, Judge Shedd.
Do you know exactly?
I don't have that exact page.
Do you think the record reflects that? My concern is this. Normally, you don't use an allegation and a complaint for summary judgment purposes. But it seems odd to me that if in the complaint he makes the assertion that would probably lead to you getting summary judgment. But yet, I didn't see that reflected exactly that same way. Because are you following me?
I am following you.
Because in the complaint, he says more than maybe. I sort of remember him saying, I was not Martha. And then I heard something else, but I hung the phone up. I didn't know what that something else was. But he says, I heard several more prompts and options. So he now admits in his complaint that he knew there were several more directions or inquiries or something. I'm using that word loosely, but there was something more by which your client wanted to continue the call. And it seems to me that statement in the complaint is a very strong statement, which I think, quite frankly, is helpful to you. But you say that the summary judgment record, factual record, is just that strong?
We do, Judge Shedd. We also believe that allegations in a complaint by a plaintiff can be their admissions, and they can be used for summary judgment. And we believe
verified? Was the complaint verified?
Justice Judge Wynn, I don't think so. I don't think it was verified.
Does it make a difference?
It does make a difference, but we believe you can still use it as an admission.
Summary judgment.
He testified.
It's an allegation, and you can prove. I mean, it's not verified. If you verify it, then yeah, I think there have been cases that say you can use complaint allegation for summary judgment.
Judge, when we believe his deposition testimony was consistent with that allegation,
does it matter if the complaint is drafted and filed by a lawyer subject to Rule 11?
You would certainly hope so, Judge Davis. And you heard Mr. Worsham stand up here. He knew the prompts, and he listened to the prompts, would direct him to a live agent. He didn't want to talk to a live agent. He wanted to set up my company for this case. He's been a...
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe he just didn't want to be bugged to death. Maybe that's what he wanted to do at the time.
If he genuinely wanted to tell Arm that his sister-in-law did not live with him and to quit calling... He's an attorney, and he could have stayed on the line.
Maybe he just doesn't feel like it's his duty to help you find out anything. Now, quite frankly, I kind of feel that way. I don't want to say debt collection companies are calling me, and that they aren't, but when I get robocalls, I don't like the fact, for what it's worth, if we're just talking about what we like, that some machine somehow can get me on the telephone and want to take up my time. Quite frankly, what right does the company have to do that? Well, maybe you have a right under the statute, is the point. I don't know whether that's a good policy. If we'd vote on policy, I'd raise my hand on the side opposite the way you are, but I don't think that's where we are.
Judge Shedd, in response to your comments, I'm happy I'm in court and not talking to you in Congress. So yeah. I can understand right. that. But right. given the statute, when you have a call that's permissible for identifying information.
I'm just wondering, do your company, your client, and companies like that, have every member of Congress on a do not call list? It might be worth thinking about.
I have not investigated that, Judge.
Yeah, it might be worth thinking about. But tell me again why it is you think that, because if there was an allegation in a complaint that hurt you on summary judgment, you'd be standing right here going, absolutely, you may not use that, correct?
I would have to produce evidence in discovery to contradict
that.
But
you'd be saying you absolutely cannot use that, correct? For summary judgment, you couldn't use it against you.
Judge Wynn, I would agree.
What changes
and
this?
Judge Davis's comment about an attorney in Rule 11, I have not investigated that.
Well, that
strengthens the allegation or not.
That's not an answer. That's not an answer.
I meant to say an attorney, a pro se attorney.
Pro se attorney.
Yeah, pro se attorney.
That didn't answer my question. If you want to adopt that as your answer, then you can say so. And I'm not saying that'd be wrong, but I'm saying tell me, and it's not argumentative, it's just something I want to understand. It makes sense that it could be used against somebody in this circumstance, but tell me what you think the theory is that a mere allegation is somehow sufficient for summary judgment purposes.
I think an allegation and an answer, an admission and an answer, or a complaint can be used for summary judgment. And if there's something that would have contradicted my case, well, I would have to develop evidence so no reasonable...
Wait a second now. Do you use admission to be in an answer? You know, sometimes an answer says, we admit paragraph one. That's an admission. Are you broadening the definition of the term admission?
I believe you have to look at the nature of the allegation and the complaint. If he's reciting a factual statement, that's a factual admission and a complaint.
Strikes me as a little bit odd. I'm not sure exactly of the answer to what I've just asked you, and I don't think I know your answer either. But it strikes me as odd that something that might well be sufficient for 12B6 purposes would not then be sufficient for summary judgment when nothing further was developed to counter that during discovery. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. If it's an admission on 12B6, why wouldn't it be an admission on summary judgment? Yeah. I would like to follow up on what Judge Wynn said. We have a couple just basic points that unanswered calls aren't communications and district courts.
Let me make sure I put that in the vein we are, because I'm not disagreeing with Judge Shedd in terms of the focus on the latter part of this. But there is a definition of communication, and if an individual says, it simply says, is this such and such, and he hangs up, he hits two and then hang up, there doesn't appear to be a communication that's required by the statute.
Yeah.
In other words, there seems to be some entitlement for you to convey this is about a debt.
Correct, Judge Wynn. I think there's two issues. One, an unanswered call we don't believe in any way is a communication under the statute. Then once there is some communication or at least spoken words, there has to be something in the communication to imply collecting on a debt. In this case, all that was asked, are you Martha? Press one. If you're not Martha, press two. He pressed two. There's other prompts and he hangs up. That's the case.
But now the problem we got, as I see it, is the district court, in looking at this, assumed there was a communication and then went directly to the summary judgment.
So yeah.
How do we deal with that? I mean, apparently they didn't make that. You didn't make that determination.
I believe there's sufficient law in the Fourth Circuit that the court can affirm the summary judgment on different grounds than the district court, as long as those grounds were presented to the district court. I don't think you have to adopt what the district court said.
What was your communication with him about if it wasn't related to debt?
It was identifying. It was trying to find Martha.
Oh, I got that, but was that related to what? You just wanted to ask Martha how she was doing in life?
There's no question, Judge Shedd. We wanted to
find Martha. It was related
to
debt, for collection of a debt. You don't really stand before us and claim or assert that this communication was in anything other than related, at least, to debt collection.
Judge Shedd, we were trying to find Martha, and once we found Martha, we were going to try to collect a debt from Martha.
So that would make it related to debt collection.
I think under a reasonable definition related, you are right, Judge Shedd. But this particular...
Otherwise, y'all just make matters worse for your company. Instead of calling people asking about debts, you just randomly call people. You don't do that, do you?
We do not do that, Judge Shedd. We were trying to find Martha, and once we found Martha, we were going to try to collect a debt from her.
But the whole purpose of the communication was, the whole purpose you were calling around was for debt collection purposes. I mean, I don't know why you're running from that.
That's the broad umbrella. This particular call was trying to find Martha. We had tried to call Martha and send her letters.
It was for the purposes, though, of collecting a debt from Martha.
Nothing in the communication
said that.
Why run away
from that question when the statute requires, that's okay for you to have that purpose, but it's got to be a conveying of the information. I mean, why run away from this question that Judge Shedd is at, which I don't see.
I can't run away from
exactly,
that.
That's exactly what you were doing.
I agree, but there's
But you didn't convey that information as required by the statute.
Correct, Judge Wynn. Correct. We didn't convey any information in that communication or in that telephone call to collect a debt.
So your theory is if he'd have answered 10, 12 questions for you and you never said we're looking for debt information on her, that you could keep calling him back?
Because
there's not a communication about debt?
Yes, Judge Shedd. That's what other courts have held, that if you're not taking the action and communicating information to collect a debt and saying Martha owes
$200. Requirement at some point, you have to say that.
I mean,
that's kind of what the act is. You have to say it.
At some point.
You cannot just keep talking and asking questions without conveying that this is about a debt.
But we also violate the statute if we talk about someone's debt with someone other than Martha, because that violates privacy rights.
Right, exactly right.
We need to find Martha before we can start the debt collection process.
Well, wait a minute now. Wait a minute. So that means you can keep calling people as many times as you want to, because it's not a communication unless you convey to them you're trying to find out something about Martha's debt?
We have to have a reasonable belief that we're, you know...
No, you what? Go ahead and finish that sentence out.
A reasonable belief to that we're trying to locate Martha to talk with her about
her debt. No. That doesn't respond to Judge Wynn's question. He suggested to you that it's not a communication that counts under the statute unless you say somehow, I'm conveying information about debt.
And I agree with that.
Well, then that gives you open season to call somebody 10, 12, 13, 18 times.
Well, under the statute, they do talk about locating information, and that's what the safe harbor is all about in the 1692B, about when you're trying to locate someone.
That's the safe harbor.
That's the safe harbor, that if you're trying to locate the person and you want to make sure you get in touch with Martha before you start conveying and communicating information about the debt. Because if you talked about the debt with Mr. Worsham and not Martha, you're violating privacy statutes.
Well, so that means the statute is completely open-ended and you can call as much as you possibly want to.
Yes, it is, because until you say
debt, it doesn't count as a communication.
The statute, if Mr. Worsham would have gone...
Just ask that question. Answer that question for me. Is it your position, if you don't say debt, or we're trying to get information to collect the debt, it's not a call or a communication that counts under the statute?
Under most portions of the statute.
Under this statute that I'm talking about, the provision I'm talking about right now, about the incomplete response.
And that is talking about locating information. I just didn't
ask you all that. I said answer my question. It says you may not communicate with any such person more than once unless requested to do so by that person, not here, or unless you reasonably believe that the earlier response is incomplete, erroneous or incomplete. But you're saying that looks like there's a limit of one call unless the response is reasonably thought to be incomplete.
Correct.
But you put a second caveat on there. You say, oh, no. As long as I haven't mentioned debt collection, I can call as many times as I want to. That's what you're saying.
If I indicated that, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you only have that one call unless it's incomplete.
You better change your answer to Judge Wynn's question then.
Okay, well, Judge Wynn, I changed my answer. What I'm saying is...
No, you changed your answer for Judge Shedd, and Judge Wynn may get on you about that answer.
No.
Well, I do want it, and the reason it comes up is I didn't come up with the definition of communication. The statute does.
Yeah.
And if the statute limits this definition to conveying of information about a debt, and the word communication is used in this statute, then the question arises is by simply saying, are you a certain person, and the person hangs up, is that communicating under the statute?
I don't believe so.
That's my understanding
of the statute.
And I'm not sure if all you do is ask the name. Anybody can keep asking the name over and over many times, but of course the statute does says a debt collector. Now you are a debt collector. There's a limitation. So there is that inconsistency.
And
I'm following Judge Shedd and very well agree with him in terms of where he's going with it. But it just seems to me the statute itself indicates conveying information about a debt. Now, is there not somewhere else in this statute that requires you to convey such information? You can't just keep talking, can you?
Yeah, there is. I don't have that section right in front of me.
I thought that was the whole purpose of it. You have to tell them what you are calling about. But why didn't you tell them before you asked where she is? I mean, it would seem to me the first thing you would say, this is a debt collector. Do you know where this lady is?
May I answer that question for you?
Because
if you did, that's exactly right. The only case law we would have here would be, what do you do when people hang up as soon as they hear you're a debt collector?
Exactly right.
Don't you think that's probably the answer?
We do believe under this statute in the safe harbor, which only applies to count three in our view, that this is a textbook definition of an incomplete call. And we were entitled to keep calling. He could have talked to a representative.
What fact in the deposition do you say establishes that?
Because he says after he hit two, he listened to the prompts and he hung up without talking to a representative. And we have evidence from our representative and ARM that the prompts direct you immediately to a representative.
Is it clear what he's... I don't think he says what the prompt says, does he?
We said what the prompt said. He didn't know. So you've got all of our evidence.
So that would be a disputed. That'd be a disputed fact.
That'd be an no reasonable. I mean, he has nothing to say on the subject. And we had the script.
No. You're absolutely wrong. You're absolutely wrong about that. The fact that you know what you're going to say doesn't mean that he knew you had said that. You would be absolutely wrong on summary judgment, because it's judged by what a reasonable person would think if his response was complete, not based on questions you wanted to ask him down the road. That's not correct at all.
He admitted deposition, though, he knew he could talk to a representative if he followed the prompts, but he chose not to. I mean,
but to say that he could, does that mean, I mean, is that as a matter of law then that his response was incomplete?
Yes. And the fact that he says he's not Martha, that is an incomplete response about whether Martha lives at the house or not. And Judge Shedd, you were talking to Mr. Worsham about that exact fact. The fact that he hit two made it an incomplete response.
Just let me suggest to you that clearly there could be a situation when the first call is, are you Martha? No. There are clearly situations under which that could be, by any reasonable standard, a complete response. Because it could be. That's just the point. That's why I'm looking at the facts of this case. It could be if you'd said, for instance, if the facts said, if a person says, I'm not Martha, there's a 30-second delay before anything kicks in. You didn't say that, but if you had, I think a court could find as a matter of law the response was complete, because that's all you ask him. And that's not a big burden on you, because then you could just change the question and say, we have a number of questions we want to ask you. First, are you Martha? Now, that might then lend that the response is not complete. But I think you're wrong about that. Let me ask.
But the incomplete response is to the entire phone call, one question.
But you missed the point. It's not judged by what you want to ask. It's a reasonable person looking at what the phone call receiver did. It's not what you want to ask. That is absolutely the wrong perspective, in my opinion. Because you can't do that. You can't say, let me just give you this hypothetical. You call, are you Martha? Yes or no? No, I'm not Martha. And then you say, well, by the way, if he'd have stayed on the line for another minute, we were going to ask him a lot more questions, so therefore his response is incomplete. That wouldn't be correct. His response to a reasonable person very well and likely would have been, as a matter of law, complete. You can't keep dead silence on the phone. I'm giving you a scenario under which to prove the fact just because you want to ask more questions, that doesn't make his response incomplete. Not at all.
A couple responses to that.
Yeah.
Judge Shedd. First of all, it's not a communication under the statute.
Well,
Number two, this safe harbor only applies to count three, which is the harassment count. As a matter of law, what happened here was not harassment.
Well, that's fine for you to say that. That didn't answer my point, though. But secondly, let me ask you this much. Is there any indication that there was a caller ID on his phone and that he knew subsequent calls that were coming from you?
There was no evidence of that I can remember in the record.
In the evidence in this case that he knew from your number that you were a debt collection agency? Didn't he say he looked up that number to see who was calling?
I don't remember that.
Well, let me tell you, he did. And I'll ask him. But I think he said, I knew who they were because I looked up that number. Now, just let me ask you this. Doesn't that suggest that there's caller ID on his telephone?
That does suggest caller ID.
Now, let me ask you this much. If in fact, hypothetical, if in fact we were to say this communication, listen to me now, this communication, that first telephone call about, are you Martha? If we were to say that was a communication about debt and that it was, you reasonably could not think his response was incomplete. In other words, you had to think it qualified as a communication and that a reasonable person would believe his response was complete. If you called subsequently and just your phone number came up on caller ID, why would that not be a subsequent call on the statute? Because you are conveying information by that unanswered call that it is, in fact, a debt collection agency, because he identifies that number, calling about, that's the only reason you'd be calling him.
Judge Shedd, debt collection agencies and other financial institutions call people all the time not to collect a debt. That is, they could be calling for a survey, could be calling to get identifying information like it occurred here.
Oh, just let me say this.
And just the fact they called all by itself, an unanswered call,
All you're arguing is then that would have to be developed on summary judgment. Because what if that number came up on caller ID, he knows that is the your debt collector's numbers, phone number, and then at deposition he asked you, were you calling me at any time of those 8 or 10 subsequent calls for to tell me to take a survey? If you had no evidence you were doing that, why wouldn't that be a subsequent call?
It would be a subsequent call. It just
for
wouldn't be
of the statute, because it's conveying information that you are calling him about a debt.
They're calling to try to find the person, not to collect on a debt in that call. That's the whole point of this. They're trying to find the person.
Yeah, no, I do not think the statute is that you can. Then the way you read the statute, and I'll let's see if anybody else has a question. You're saying until and unless we're saying we are calling to collect on a debt, and you're limited in when and how you can say that you can call somebody as many times as you want to.
No, I think there is a time period where it becomes harassment,
limited,
especially when Mr. Wilson tells
only,
you.
Limited only by harassment. Limited only by harassment.
No, I think there's various state statutes that limit the number of calls
this
and
statute,
the time periods.
So the one that you may communicate only once, what limitation does that have? Then what limitation does that put in the statute?
It says only one.
But you define that
incomplete.
As short of harassment, we can call you as many times as we want to, unless and until we tell you we're looking for debt information.
There's other portions of this statute and state statutes all over the country that limit the number of times you
can contact someone. But my point is, you say there's nothing in that language of that statute that limits your call.
In that provision.
I mean, unlimited.
It
up to harassment.
Well, there could be other limits that
but
I'm not thinking of.
Harassment something else I would limit. The point is, the way you read that statute is, that imposes no limitations on you.
Sure it does. If we're told,
Marsha, unless until you say we're looking to collect on the
debt. If it's an incomplete call, we can
No. But you define that as, no, it's not even a I'm talking about the communications. You would be limited on the back end by whether or not it was complete. But you say until we mention debt, it doesn't even count in the first instance. We don't even go to the question of completeness.
I agree with that.
Okay. That's all right. You have any questions?
Follow up one point. We've spent a lot of time on that first phrase, unless you reasonably believe it's incomplete, as a conjunctive phrase after it that says, and that such person now has correct or complete information. How did you come about satisfying that part of it, that the person who just hung up and says they are not the person you're seeking does in fact you can reasonably believe they now have correct or complete information?
In this factual scenario, we were sued. We kept making the calls. I think there was 11 of them total. Mr. Worsham only talked to us twice. He never got to a live representative and told us that Diana or Martha didn't live at his residence. Then without ever talking to anyone at ARM at all, either a representative or the company, he filed the lawsuit.
I'm still trying. I want to make sure you understand. Assume the communication, as the district court did, this communication, you now can only get under this exception unless you reasonably believe that it was incomplete and that such person now has the correct or complete information. How do you satisfy that last phrase?
That comes from the information we obtained on the scrub from Alexis that it was his sister-in-law, and this was a number that he may have been living at.
It seems to be that you obtained something then that now gives you the belief that they have it.
If it was an incomplete call, what could we have obtained? If it was an incomplete call, it obviously presumes we didn't obtain.
So that last phrase is superfluous then?
It's either superfluous or it talks about do we have the good faith reason to call the number to begin with.
Or it means something more.
One thing I do want to say is that safe harbor provision is not required for us to win. That count three on harassment, this was not a harassing situation as a matter of law,
okay,
and it wasn't a communication.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Do you feel like you have to make most of your argument in the last 30 seconds? All right, Mr. Worsham.
Thank you. I'd like to spend 1 minute on the other counts that we didn't discuss at all and then get back to this, because that's where I figure we'll close out the argument, and that is on the Maryland Telephone Consumer Protection Act claims that basically say that they didn't identify the individual caller or provide a phone number during their calls, whether they left the message or not. I don't have anything more to add to my brief, and you haven't asked any questions about it. Getting back to the others, No, the complaint was not verified, and as you just stated, I did not ever speak with a live person at ARM.
Did you find out this number belonged to a debt collection agency or something like that?
Yeah, it is in my affidavits in the joint appendix that by, I don't know, third or fourth, fifth call that I could see the same number appearing on caller ID, not a name, just a number, and from that did search and figure it out. And the definition of communication is paraphrasing closely, though, what it's conveying directly or indirectly through any medium. And it occurred to me today that I could include the, like you just maybe are alluding to, caller ID information, as a way of letting at least a person know, okay, this is the same person calling again. But I want to point out that the counts that are at issue here, including this main one that we've been talking about, don't require a quote communication as defined by the Act. The issue, the part is in page, quoted page 13 of the brief. It says, quote, any debt collector communicating with any person other than the consumer for the purpose of acquiring location information about the consumer shall not communicate with any such person more than once unless requested to do so or unless they reasonably believe the earlier response was erroneous or incomplete.
In your deposition, did you say that you heard other prompts and decided not to respond to them? Is that what you said in your deposition? The other side said that's what you said.
I would have to...
Okay, if you don't...
Yes, I heard some prompts, not a live person, and not questions like I believe you suggested might be perhaps better for them to prompt you with, like, do you have location information about Martha? I don't recall hearing anything like that. It was just stuff that... And I would raise the issue, and I don't know whether it works for either side, is what if they do have a reasonable belief that the person they're calling has the more information, and that person says, I don't want to talk to you. I'm not going to give it to you. Under their, theory or understanding of the law, they could keep calling because they have a reasonable belief that you have the information. We're going to keep
calling. Apparently, you didn't want to bring that case, though, right? Because you said in your deposition you didn't want to talk to a live human being.
I didn't want to talk. I didn't know. As I said in
you agree. You said that, right?
Said
page 88 of the joint appendix. Quote: I didn't want to speak to anybody at this company.
Yeah, that would be
right.
Correct.
So I'm not sure where you're going with your last comment. You could have brought the case that you just posited, but you chose not to because you didn't want to talk to a live human being.
Yeah, I think Judge Shedd asked that or said that that's a reasonable interpretation, that it's completed the person, not because it was wanted to set up a lawsuit, you just didn't want to talk to him.
The only thing I suggested was that you could think of a scenario under which, notwithstanding the other side's litany of questions, under the facts, a reasonable person could think the response was complete. But Judge Davis points out, and he's correct, that was just a hypothetical to explore. Not the facts of this case. That's not the facts of this case. See, you'd have an entirely different case had you said, okay, I'm waiting for a person. Let me tell you guys something. I don't give information over the phone to anybody about anything. You can call me 1,000 times. I'm not telling you anything. I don't know who you are. Sorry. Hung up then. You might have one heck of a case that, as a matter of law, your response was complete, and no reasonable person could think that it wasn't. That's what Judge Davis is pointing out. That's not the case that we have in front of us.
Well, in this case, the facts are such that a person could reasonably conclude that the response was complete.
But you knew there was more stuff coming to you after you pressed 2.
Well, let me make sure we're clear. It wasn't a stuff or a prompt that said press another digit.
I understand that.
It was just...
But it said, are you Martha? Press 1 if you are. Press 2 if you're not. You pressed 2, and you heard more stuff coming.
Something else, yes.
Right.
And that
and
was
you
that.
Chose to ignore whatever was coming, and you specifically didn't want to talk to a human being.
If one was to come on, I...
In fact, you hung up before a human being could pick up, didn't you?
That's as best as I recall.
That's exactly what you intended to do, right?
You want to take up. Yeah, I'm not... And that gets to this...
I mean, you knew more stuff was coming, but you hung up. The reason you didn't want to listen to what was coming is because you were concerned that it might be a real human being.
I knew it was a debt collector, and I didn't have any... I never, as I said in the affidavit,
well,
I didn't know who it was.
That contradicts what you said a few minutes ago to Judge Shedd. You knew it was a debt collector the first call you got, didn't you? Your background.
Pretty much, I assumed.
And your experience. But you make your living suing debt collectors, well, don't you?
For clients, yeah.
For clients. You got a client here.
The call where the press, too, occurred was not the first or second call. It was a couple calls in. Okay, so... By that point, I knew it. I have very limited time. I do want to emphasize what Judge Wynn asked about the second part of that, and that the person or that the debt collector really believes that the person now has complete or correct information. And again, back to page 37, the appendix, where all they got, the debt collector from Lexis, was a couple of phone numbers, which they don't know anything about. And I don't know how you go from that to these reasonable beliefs after, in this case, they've already been told, you know, no, it's not Martha. And I think that's the end of my time.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We'll step down. Great counsel.